We know that what really, really counts is what children learn at school. The work that's come out about the links between specifically the quality of schooling from an early age and subsequent economic growth, economists can bring in the dismal science of saying, well, actually, guys, we can't do everything. What should we choose and what outcomes would that bring about?
Continuing with our 1994 to now policy paper series, today we shift focus to the evolution of basic education in South Africa, a topic that, while part of a wider education policy architecture, is central and too often overlooked. I'm Margot G, and welcome to OSA's podcast series. 30 years ago, South Africa's education system emerged from the shadow of apartheid with a bold mission to dismantle deep inequalities and build a future of equal opportunity. Since then, we've seen several reforms aimed at enhancing foundational learning, improving assessment mechanisms, and aligning the education system with socioeconomic needs. But the journey has been far from straightforward. Some policies have delivered real gains. Others have stumbled on design flaws, language complexities, and the tug of war between government and teacher unions. Over the past 30 years, what has impacted basic education policy in South Africa? Where does foundational learning sit in South Africa's education agenda? And how is it prioritized internationally? With me today is Professor Martin Gustafsson, co-author of the paper Basic Education Policy from 1994 to Now, and Associate Professor at the University of Stellenbosch. Today, we'll look at how basic education policy has evolved in South Africa. We'll discuss what has worked, what hasn't, and explore the current opportunities and the lessons that can help policymakers and researchers develop policies that will ensure every child in South Africa gets the start they deserve. Welcome, Professor. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our show today. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Hi, Margaret. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So before we delve into the findings of your research, could you share your journey into economics? And what drew you specifically to research in basic education policy?
I am actually originally a teacher, a history and English teacher, secondary level. I did teach at a school in Limpopo. And then in the tumultuous 90s, I ended up in the Gauteng Department of Education and realized that, well, I was asked to work in the information section because I'd done some programming, but I realized quite quickly that we really didn't know what we were doing very well. I mean, at a policy level, things were looking all right, perhaps, but in terms of just the operations, a lot needed to be done. I mean, these were quite, eventful years. So at that point, I thought one of two things, I should pursue studies in one of two things. The one was economics, because it would provide a framework for taking decisions. And that was what seemed really difficult, was taking decisions, understanding trade-offs, and so on. And I thought, well, economics is surely good for that. The other thing was information systems, which is and remains a huge issue and often a big hurdle in government. Then in about 2000, I moved to the national department. And by that point, I had kind of decided to pursue economics. And well, how many years later? It was 15 years later, I actually got my PhD. So I got in economics, economic models of growth and education, or education in economic growth models. And yeah, so I basically got into economics on the job. And because, you know, I worked in the, not just even more narrowly than the education sector, specifically the schooling sector, not so much the post-school sector, the economics that I've been able to really drill into is economics of education and the economics of schooling systems in particular. And I think, well, as a lot of economists working in government would say, I mean, you know, maybe one struggles to use the economic theory and to convey the economic theory within government, because what economists are often used for is just to work with data in whichever sector they happen to be. So government has a lot of data, and in the Department of Basic Education, which is where I'm based at the moment, I live in Pretoria. I am also with the University of Stellenbosch. Yeah, I mean, in the Department of Basic Education, we have a lot of data, of course, on financing. There's the teacher payroll data. There's the data on outcomes, the grade 12 examinations data, all sorts of assessment data from other grades. So a lot of data, not enough capacity to use the data. So yeah, one ends up being pulled wherever there's data.
Yes, and in the age of big data, our modeling techniques in economics are also evolving. I'm curious though, did you, after all, say that economics made it easier to make decisions?
Absolutely. And I think there's an appreciation of that amongst the education colleagues in government. Sometimes it's a bit of a reluctant appreciation, because I think in education, we tend to want to do everything. We tend to want to prioritize way too many things without considering the cost. And education economists can bring in the dismal science of saying, well, actually, guys, we can't do everything. What should we choose? What are the criteria we use to choose? And what outcomes would that bring about? And what are the outcomes we should worry about? I mean, we know, you know, post 2000, with the work that's come out and that has been embraced by UNESCO about the links between specifically the quality of schooling from an early age and subsequent economic growth, we know that what really, really counts is what children learn at school. And I think that's something important that economics brings to the kind of schooling policy area.
Yeah, it's a beautiful subject. I love it for a bunch of reasons. So your paper identifies three distinct periods, each which broadly prioritized specific things regarding education policy since 1994. Looking back, what have been the most transformative shifts, and where have the biggest disappointments or missed opportunities been?
I think we should not kind of underestimate what an amazing thing South Africa did immediately after 94. I mean, non-South Africans have looked at this and said, my goodness, this is probably one of the biggest structural shifts that has ever occurred in a schooling system. So there was a lot of attention paid to the financing, the human resourcing of the system, to try and kind of correct as many of the apartheid anomalies as possible, which specifically meant standardizing teacher salaries, standardizing learner-educator ratios across schools, standardizing public financing per child, and in fact making it a little bit pro-poor. There were formulas to do that. Although, I mean, South Africa is not, you know, remarkably pro-poor in its public funding. There are other countries that are, I think, even more pro-poor. But there were major changes in that area during the first period that I identified, or that myself and Kolosa, the paper was done by myself and Kolosa Nonkenge, a colleague from the Department of Basic Education. So in that first period up to 2005, there wasn't really much time to do anything except undo apartheid. So that's what we did. Then I have another two periods. There was a period where, kind of in the wake of South Africa's SACMEC shock, I call it the SACMEC shock in a way as an allusion to fairly well-documented thing that happened in Germany, which was the PISA shock. You know, the Germans thought they were doing fairly well in their schooling system, and then they realized through the international PISA tests, my goodness, we're actually not doing that well. And it led to a lot of reforms in Germany. Here in South Africa, we had a kind of South African almost arrogance that surely we must be doing a little better than other African countries, despite our history. So 2005 was a bit of a watershed year because the results of the initial SACMEC testing came out, and we saw that we were well below Kenya, for example, Tanzania, and we realized, my goodness, we have a quality problem. We also started questioning this whole idea that, you know, equalizing resourcing is enough on its own. Clearly, that was not going to be enough. We needed to do more. And so under Minister Pandor, a lot of things were started to improve learning, especially in historically Black schools, especially primary schools. And these things included the National Workbooks Program, which has been lauded by UNESCO. It's these, you know, hundreds of pages of full color books that were in a flooded the schooling system, and children owned these books so they could take them home. They didn't have to give them back to the school at the end of the year. So it was a way of kind of stocking up households, not just schools, in South Africa. That was something that was initiated then. Very, very successful. Where we were less successful, I think, was on the side of assessments and accountability. So we introduced something called the annual national assessments, which in some ways were designed along the lines of the grade 12 examinations. Even the kind of format and the ceremony of the minister announcing the provincial results once a year was quite shaped along the lines of what grade 12 had been doing for many, many years. And there were several problems with the annual national assessments. Yeah, one being that these results were not really comparable over time. And if you looked at the small print in the reports, in the ANA reports, it was stated that these results are not really comparable, but everyone treated them as if they were comparable. So, and they were not comparable because of the way the testing occurred, the way the marking of the tests occurred. It would have been very difficult to make a program such as ANA truly comparable across time because it involved so many learners. It was not sample-based. It was a huge machine and produced a lot of data, but was eventually stopped. Not only teacher unions, but even a lot of education academics did not like this. I would have preferred it to be fixed, but it was stopped in 2015. So I think here we have kind of an indication of one of our key weaknesses in South Africa. I think our capacity to design appropriate fit for purpose assessments below grade 12. Our grade 12 examinations are fairly good, well designed, but you need different kinds of assessments, and different assessments serve different purposes. There's school accountability, there's tracking trends for the whole system or for entire provinces over time. These assessments require different types of interventions and designs. So I think that's one area where, yeah, we did not do well. And it's almost as if the schooling system was in a bit of a post-traumatic shock mode after 2015. Nobody wanted to talk about assessments. We skirted around the issue, and you know, in my timeline, I then said that, well, it's almost as if we abandoned the primary level a little bit and went back to the secondary level and started talking about things like vocational subjects and diversifying the curriculum and so on. Some of the primary things continued. For example, the workbooks continue to this day. Thank goodness. They're a very, very good element within the system. And yeah. But then in this third period, I think, again, it's this period, this post-2015 period where we started looking again at the secondary level. I think some of the planning problems that we have in the country came to the fore, in particular, the nuts and bolts of budgeting. How much is this going to cost? You know, it's not just a matter of wanting, you know, diversity in the curriculum, more vocational subjects. How do you do that? How do you do that in a South African context where we have a history of apartheid education, and there was a certain type of schooling for the poor and then a certain other type of schooling for the white middle class.
Yeah.
That's our history. So if you start to say schools are going to do things a bit differently, some are going to be more vocational than others, does that not become controversial in the historical sense, where a lot of South Africans value an academic education? You can't just do away with that. Maybe we overvalue it, but it is still a societal demand. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it certainly makes sense to, at the very least, have options, but not at the cost of a strong foundation. So you mentioned in the first period, some provinces such as the Western Cape experimented with approaches inspired by countries like Uruguay. Which provincial or school level innovations stand out to you as having real potential for national scaling?
Okay, well, first of all, I'm not so sure that Western Cape specifically looked to Uruguay for an inspiration. I mean, in the paper, so we describe assessment interventions that were emerging around the world. Uruguay is a particularly well-documented one, and Western Cape did do something similar, but I'm not too sure that they specifically looked for Uruguay. But so what Western Cape did, and we're talking now 2002 already, they, at a very early point, decided that they do need comparable and standardized information on what learning outcomes are seen at the primary level. So for a while, every second year, and then for every year, they would send external people to schools. Children in grades 3 and 6 would be assessed. So it wasn't a matter of assessing everyone in the way Anna did some years later. It was quite targeted at particular grades, and they collected the data. I think Western Cape could have done a lot more with this data, but it provided some sense in the district offices of where were schools really struggling to get children to read and do basic mathematics. So Western Cape brought in an absolutely vital information element. ANA was meant to do that nationally starting in about 2010. But as I mentioned earlier, its design was just not appropriate. It wasn't designed for its purpose, and even its purpose was not terribly clear. So it was stopped. And as I mentioned, you know, it's almost as if the country or the schooling system, you know, skirted around assessment and understanding learning outcomes for some years. Western Cape, by the way, did continue with their systemic tests, and they continue to this day. But fortunately, I think more recent years, there's been a return to thinking more systematically about understanding and supporting schools in the area of, yeah, the basics, the fundamentals, your reading, your mathematics. And there was an article of mine that came out in the Daily Maverick last year where I described the Gauteng approach, which I think is quite promising and perhaps more replicable than what Western Cape is doing, because its costs are lower, it's kind of easier to manage. So what Gauteng currently does is very similar to what Kenya has been doing in its Tusome program. So what Gauteng does is that every year there's a schedule of schools that the district offices have to visit. They don't visit every school every year, but they go to a certain number of schools. They have a little toolkit. They have a tablet with an assessment tool. They ask for the list of the learners in specific grade. They've been focusing a lot on grade, I think it is grade 4. And they will then randomly select a few learners, and they will say, okay, you know, we want to talk to them, we want to assess them. They make the learners feel comfortable, and then they get the learners to just read. They read a text, And the assessors check, okay, how many words did this child get right? And how fast or slow is the reading? And then they ask some comprehension questions. So it's a very simple test. They haven't gone into mathematics yet in a big way. But the advantage with this kind of approach is it feeds comparable and quite reliable data into the administration, which then can see, oh my goodness, there's a red flag here. In this school, the sample of 10 or whatever learners we assessed, they're really, really struggling. We need to do something. We need to look more deeply into what's happening in this school. It's not a very high cost program. Western Cape's is more costly because it involves assessing all learners, not samples of learners. And very often, depending on what you want to achieve, a sampling approach is adequate. And I think that's one of the things we often struggle with is when to use sampling and when do we need more universal type assessment. Even Gauteng's approach is sufficient to bring about some kind of accountability for schools. I mean, if primary schools know that this is happening, there's a sense that we need to pay attention to the reading of learners. And yeah, I mean, frankly, it's an embarrassment for the school if they do poorly, and it does help to kind of bring about targeted support and accountability.
Definitely. So the assessments are one key component of standardizing and looking at how the students are doing. But when you mention the quality, what can you say about the quality of the teachers and the resources that they have available to them in order to support the students with their needs?
Yeah. So one of the things we do in the paper is we use this framework of support accountability. I've been talking a lot about assessment and accountability. Obviously, support to schools is also important, and the two kind of need to go together. And this is a really, really important kind of fundamental strategic issue. I know sometimes my education colleagues will tell me, Martin, you know, why are you, you know, emphasizing accountability so strongly? You know, we first need to capacitate teachers. Yes, of course we need to capacitate teachers. And we are, and there are a lot of different interventions that are currently doing that. They should be better. There are some, South Africa is kind of on the forefront of research into supporting teachers on how to conduct their classes in better ways, how to use within class assessment and feedback and so on. So there's a lot of important work that's happening there. Sometimes one will hear the argument that, no, we first need to have a proper, you know, widespread system of support before we can hold people accountable. And my take is, but that's an incorrect understanding of accountability. Accountability is not that everything needs to be perfect. Accountability is simply saying that we're doing the best we can with the resources we have, with the skills we have, and importantly, with the learners we have. It's not the same teaching learners from an informal settlement to teaching suburban learners. It's very, very different. And that has to be taken into account. And good accountability systems do take that into account. So I lost my train of thought here for a moment, but yeah. So we need both. We need support and we need accountability. Support, I mean, also takes the form of good materials for students. For me, the workbooks program is an excellent support program because it provides resources for the classroom that facilitate the work of the teacher. Yeah, now I remember what I was going to say. So, I mean, the argument that I make in order to kind of underline this point that we need both support and accountability is that one of the things we've learned from SACMEC, it's very interesting, is that now SACMEC tests learners across many countries and teachers. And if you look at, if you compare South Africa and Swazini, South Africa's teachers do a little bit better than Eswatini's teachers at the primary level. South Africa's teachers do better. But when it comes to learners, it's the other way around. Eswatini, which is a poorer country than South Africa, have learners who display better skills than South Africa's learners. So what this suggests is that a lot we could, yes, of course, we have capacity constraints when it, constraints when it comes to our teachers. But if our neighbor with even worse constraints is getting better results, you have to, that raises questions. And I think, you know, in the case of these two countries, I think Eswatini has been better at accountability. They have a little exam at the end of primary schooling, and it's a, yeah, it works. Accountability in primary schools is a lot stronger in Eswatini. And I think that explains some of this, this gap.
Very interesting. So after our Shuck and our Foundations for Learning campaign, where would you say we now rank internationally? What progress have we made?
Okay, this is a big thing that comes up in Parliament and various places. There's enormous amounts of confusion. The World Economic Forum, I think, it has done the education a bit of a disservice by, they used to publish these rankings where South Africa was actually, I think, sometimes at the very bottom of 200 countries. These rankings were incidentally based on the opinions of kind of business leaders in the country. So it just meant that in South Africa, there was a high awareness that there's a quality problem. It didn't mean objectively that there is a quality problem, but there is a quality problem in South Africa, even if you look at good international assessment data. We're not bottom of the world, but we are an outlier. We are below, or we have been below, where we should be. Up until recently, however, we, in the 2023 TIMSS testing, this was a very, very interesting set of data. We participated in TIMSS in 2023. This is grade 9 mathematics and science. And for the first time, we were kind of on the line. We were displaying an expected level of performance on a par with Brazil, for example. Now, Brazil is not a great performer in these education tests either, but developing countries tend to be fairly low down. But we were not an outlier. So at least at the secondary level, I think, well, the data suggests that we have now, we're a bit more like a normal developing country. That doesn't mean that we don't have big quality problems, but they look more like the quality problems in other developing countries. 20 years ago, we were way out in the wilderness. We were a complete, total outlier. You could see that in any kind of scatter plot. South Africa was way down there at the bottom. But there have been improvements over the last 20 years, which is something that people, even in government, find a bit difficult to believe, I think, because they're skeptical. But it has been happening. It's very clear from the data, and it's helped us to become more like a regular developing country. The 2024 McKinsey Global Report on Education is interesting. It looked for examples of improvers, significant improvers around the world. And three developing countries stood out for them: Peru, Morocco, and South Africa. So South Africa is an exceptional improver. Now, this often baffles people because they say, but the quantity is poor, you know, children can't read and so on. Yes, but it was even worse 20 years ago. And I mean, I've done papers for UNESCO on, you know, I call it sometimes the speed limit and how fast do countries improve. If you look at the history of educational quality, it's pretty dismal. Improvements seldom happen. And when they happen about at the speed of South Africa. South Africa's speed of improvement means we can reach Malaysia, where Malaysia is today, in about 15 to 20 years. Now, that may sound like a very long time, but in the education world, it's difficult to see anything happening faster than that, unless you have some new technology that totally changes the way schooling happens. So it's like one of those inconvenient truths about education is that improvements can happen, they should happen, but when they happen, even small improvements should be considered quite an achievement.
Yes, definitely. And in your paper, you mentioned how even the policy with the Foundations for Learning provided improvements despite all the implementation issues and design flaws that were there. And if we move more recently, we've had a lot of changes with the integration of early childhood development into the Department of Basic Education. We've also had COVID-19, which was very disruptive for many learners. And there's this advent of AI and new technology coming in. How would you say these developments can affect basic education policy and what needs to happen next to make the most of them?
I have to admit that I'm still a bit lost when it comes to the role of AI. And I think a lot of people are lost when it comes to the role of AI in education. There's a huge variety of different messages coming from different people. I think we need to look very, very carefully at this, not just in South Africa. In the schooling sector, there's obviously the potential for AI, but not just AI. I mean, even the technology that, you know, existed 10 years ago, the digital technologies allowed for more individualized learning in classrooms so that learners could move at a comfortable pace, because that is a huge problem in a schooling system, especially where you have very large classes. It's difficult to set your teaching at the right level. So, but then you have to ask yourself the question, I mean, if these technologies existed 10 years ago, why have they not been impactful, not just in South Africa, but even elsewhere? There's a lot of skepticism around the initiatives that have taken place. You know, if you listen to Andreas Schleicher, the head of PISA, it's one of the things he says over and over again: be very careful about, falling for this too easily. One has to look at specific reasons why these new technologies may not work. My sense is that you cannot leave teachers out of the equation. So teachers will not be able to use technologies that they themselves don't understand or embrace. So a lot of people argue that the first logical step is not to give these technologies to learners, but rather to capacitate teachers through new digital technologies. And then they can kind of buy in, understand what this means, they would then be more equipped to take learners forward. Of course, I'm talking about the average here in South Africa. There are, elite middle-class schools that use technology in amazing ways, but that's a small niche. And we shouldn't think that one can very easily transplant that into schools across the whole country very easily. Number one, because of teacher capacity, but also for the very simple reason that these devices need to be charged and there are electricity supply problems. Yeah, and that's ignoring problems around security and theft and so on. So, I think that for the time being, we do need to continue to focus on making sure that teachers at the primary level are able to deliver good classes, even without technology, technology innovation. If technology innovation can make that better, good. But there's nothing that's, we don't have much that's kind of proven that we can readily take out on scale.
Yeah, I guess we'd have to look at how best it can be used most responsibly. It's very powerful, but it needs to be used responsibly. So in your paper, also more recently, you speak about the fiscal constraints. And if I remember correctly, you said 18% higher budget on secondary education than basic education. What does the economist in you say about the opportunity cost of increasing budget towards basic education policy?
You mean financing basic education better relative to other government priorities?
Yes. If we had to shift funds away from other departments into basic education.
Well,
can't have it all.
Yeah. Yeah. This is highly topical right now. I know the Minister of Basic Education is engaged in a process around talking to Treasury on the matter of the financial or funding crisis in basic education. Yes. I suppose there are arguments that can be made for prioritizing basic education a bit more. We do know that there was a shift towards post-school education triggered largely by Fees Must Fall and increased funding for NISFAS. And while I think it was justified, in fact, I made enemies, you know, amongst my basic education colleagues by saying, you know, well, post-school education must expand in South Africa. And it's more important to expand that than to expand schooling. Because the schooling system, let's not forget that this participation in the schooling system in South Africa is amongst the highest in the world, even comparing developed countries. Our participation levels are really high. So yet at the post-school level, our participation levels are actually quite low. Our enrollment levels are low. It's very clear that we are kind of skewed towards basic education. Now, the political pressures around triggered by Fees Must Fall did succeed in getting government's priority to move more towards post-school education, which in principle was right. However, I think that should have been focused more on getting more students as opposed to funding each student more. I think the balance got a bit lost in the process. So I think we are doing more funding without the benefit of more enrollments, which is what we really need. So, yeah, I mean, there are certainly some arguments that can be made in favor of basic education. So, I mean, I've been looking at province specificities, and it's clear, I think Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga seem to have cut their basic education budgets more than was justified by the equitable shared trends and so on. And then another issue that I often bring up, and it's very difficult to communicate this, but the equitable share formula rests to a fairly large degree on population numbers and population trends, which are provided by Stats SA. South Africa, like most developing countries, has a number of problems in its population estimates, especially if you start breaking them down below the national level. And we now have relatively good data in education at the level of individual learners. We can get numbers that are not based on any modeling. I mean, these are administrative systems. And if you do a careful comparison of what we have from our learner data in basic education to the population estimates of Stats SA, you can see there are a few anomalies. In recent years, for example, Mpumalanga has, for some reason, been losing out in terms of population in Stats SA's estimates. But if you look at the education data, you don't see the same trend. So I think there's a bit of a modeling problem there. It's inherently difficult to model population. And I think that StatsSA should, to a larger degree, make use of data like ours in basic education in the modeling process. So one, there are specific province-specific issues that I think need to be resolved. But these things, unfortunately, they require capacity. And as the National Development Plan says, we do lack capacity in government and to grapple with these kinds of things well. I mean, I always, you know, when I talk about capacity building within the administration, I emphasize two things: data and law. So data is something that I've focused a lot on. I have been involved in training exercises, but we need to do a lot more. There is just not enough capacity in government to work with data. And I think sometimes the partnerships with universities should be stronger. I mean, I think that in education, one of the good things we have is that a relatively strong series of partnerships on the economics front, Stellenbosch and the Department of Basic Education work quite well together. And I think that is valuable, but we need more capacity in government. Law is not something that I focused on specifically, but I know enough about it to see that there should be more people who understand the legal aspects of policy formulation, contradictions in laws, consequences, responsibilities, and so on. I think not an insufficient understanding of how law works in basic education often gets us into trouble.
Yeah, I can see why you say that. So looking ahead, based on what you've been saying in terms of collaborations with governments and universities, or even broader, how can the Government of National Unity build a more cohesive theory of change for the sector, ensuring best use with the limited budgets going forward?
Yeah, I'd go back to the issue of technical capacity in government. I think that we don't have kind of sufficiently focused programs on building up that capacity. I think we have an opportunity here, not just because of the Government of National Unity and the politics of that, but also because there's a generational shift currently in government. I mean, a lot of people who like myself, came into government in those tumultuous 1990s and, came in with a specific worldview and so on, are retiring. And younger people are moving in. And we need to make sure that these younger people have as good a kind of technical capacity as possible. So I would emphasize that. I think that all the parties, ANC, DA, others involved in the Government of National Unity, should all use this as an opportunity to up, even within their parties, their policy development and formulation capacity. I think across all parties, there's definitely room for improvement. A lot of things that parties are putting out there are quite aspirational, not informed by what's possible, and not sufficiently informed by what is really necessary for the development of the country. I mean, part of a democracy's development process is to have really good little think tanks within political parties.
Yeah. Okay, so then on to the most urgent and pressing research issues for our listeners that are interested in education policy. Based on these priorities, what would you say is the most urgent research space for them to tap into?
I'm reluctant to kind of pinpoint one or two things, because there are a number of things, and there are a number of areas which require more work. And I think that researchers, finding their way in this domain should you know, if you focus on what you are passionate about, chances are you will produce things that are valuable. Maybe even, on the frontier, on the knowledge frontier, there is a lot of education data that is available, partly through UCT's Data First. The Department of Basic Education has worked quite closely with Data First to get data out. And right now, in fact, we're working on getting learner level data to permit more kind of demographic analysis. You know, if I was to choose one thing, maybe this is a bit personal because this is something I've been looking at recently and it fascinates me. We clearly need more young people getting good mathematics marks. And above all, we need more Black youths with good mathematics marks that allows them into the kinds of professions where we have a shortfall and where the economy suffers because of that shortfall. Now, the output has been improving, which, you know, one would expect. If you know, the TIMSS grade 9 results are improving, there must be something better coming out at grade 12 as well. So that improvement has been happening. But what is fascinating is for Black learners, how uneven it is across the country. And we don't understand that sufficiently. Specifically, quite a lot of work that I've done and which is out in the public domain has looked at the fact that amongst young Black grade 12s, if you are in Limpopo, your probability of getting that 60% mark and having doors open is actually considerably higher than it is if you're a Black learner in Gauteng, Western Cape, Free State. And if you look within each province, you often find that rural schools do better than urban schools. The flip side of that is, of course, you know, urban schools are perhaps not doing as well as they should, because you'd expect them to do relatively well because of access to resources, often better teachers and so on. But there seems to be an urban problem in South Africa. And I think part of this is because race is not sufficiently used in our analysis. So, I think it's, in a way, it's a bit bizarre that we have an affirmative action system in the country. We have the Employment Equity Act, which requires employers to look at representativity, which is a good thing, given South Africa's history. But then the schooling system and the education system as a whole hardly ever reports on race. You know, it should. I mean, I'm not suggesting that, you know, there should be like hard, you know, race-specific targets, but at least there needs to be some focus. Just as there's a focus on gender, there needs to be a focus on how are we closing the gap, the historical race-based gap. And we have been closing it, but I think we need more information if we're going to grapple properly with that historical gap.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you so much, Professor. Is there anything else you would like to add? Anything else for our listeners?
No, thank you. Thank you very much. This has been a great opportunity. Yeah, and all the best for ARSA. It was a wonderful conference you organized this year, and yeah, great.
Thank you so much. It is our absolute pleasure having you on our show today. And for our listeners, I highly, highly recommend reading Professor Gustafsson's paper. I might be biased in saying it, your experience in history and English definitely shows in the beautiful writing and ease of readability. So thank you not only for giving us a beautiful paper, but also a wonderful, all the contribution you've made just to your research and your incredible experience from all sectors and pulling it all together with such a clear direction and focus. So thank you so much for everything. It's been such a pleasure getting the opportunity to learn from you and to listen to you and to have the conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mona.
Thank you. And to our listeners, if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our socials on LinkedIn and Twitter. We have also expanded onto Instagram and Facebook again. This is your host, Margot G. from the Ursa Podcast series. Till next time.